Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Welcome to Many Happy Returns, where we aim to make you a better investor. I'm Roman.
And I'm Michael.
Last week, Daniel Kahneman died aged 90. He was the pioneer of behavioural economics and won a Nobel Prize for his work on cognitive biases. By explaining how a litany of psychological missteps skew our decisions, few people have had more influence on investing.
And in today's dumb question of the week, are stock analysts' price targets worth anything at all? All right, let's get into it. So sadly, Daniel Kahneman passed away, and he was a hugely influential psychologist whose reach expanded into economics and got applied into investing as well. And he's one of those people where I'd heard all his ideas, but didn't really know they all came from him until I started researching this podcast. And Roman, I have to say, he's been hugely influential on your thinking about investment.
Yeah, definitely. I use his stuff all the time. You know, if you just look at what we say about investing on PensionCraft, a lot of the ideas come from Kahneman. But of course, it's not just from him. He took ideas from other psychologists and expanded on them. So I use a lot of psychological theory in what we do because I think that's likely to help people.
And we've said so many times that your behavior, the decisions you make and the errors in those decisions, is by far the biggest impact on your long-term returns.
Absolutely. And this is what some people don't realize. You know, they think investing is all about, you know, which assets shall I buy? Is it about fancy derivatives to control my risk? Whereas the biggest risk is you. You're doing the wrong thing, potentially, and hurting your long-term prospects. So I think what I love about Kahneman is he identifies how things can go wrong and also how you can address those problems. And I think that's a huge contribution to the world of investing.
So shall we start with prospect theory, which is kind of a collection of ideas which really brought Kahneman to attention, I think, in the academic world. And one way to characterize prospect theory is what we might know as loss aversion.
Yeah, that's the one people usually focus on, although there is something else that we'll mention in a moment. But the basic idea here is that the joy of a 20% gain is outweighed by the grief of a 20% loss. So equal size movements, but our emotional reaction to those equal size movements in opposite directions is completely different and asymmetric.
Yeah, so I saw the example that if you imagine a coin toss, in which you lose £100 if it lands on tails, how much would you have to win on heads to be willing to take that bet? And when you survey people, you know, obviously you should expect it to be 100, right? Or 101, something like that, so it's slightly in your favour. People say at least £200 on average. So really, losses maybe feel twice as bad as gains, which skews all our decisions.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking, the asymmetry, and I think it explains so much of what I hear about people's worries when they come to invest. A lot of it does come down to these ideas about asymmetry of risk. For example, at the moment, people are worried that they're going to lose money because the US is too concentrated in just a handful of stocks, or the US is overvalued and that's going to push down stocks. There's always something that worries people. And usually it's best just to invest as much as you can for as long as you can.
In the right things, yeah.
Yeah, in the right things, clearly.
I think there's also a question of scale here when we're talking about losses being more painful than gains are pleasurable. Is that if you're talking about your life savings, losing all your life savings is obviously going to be much worse than doubling your life savings. So it seems to me that the size of the bet we're making does matter.
And the other thing I've noticed is as people get older, they become more risk averse, rationally, I think, because what you want to avoid is unrecoverable loss. And I think that's what people fear most. But if you're young, then I don't think many losses are unrecoverable.
And most of the things we're doing in investing aren't going to cause us unrecoverable losses. If we're talking about an index fund, maybe the worst case is going down 50%. Peak to trough. Like obviously, there's one example in history, the Great Depression, which was more like 90%. But those are so, so rare.
But there are certain types of investment where 100% loss is possible. If you have a 3x leverage fund and the fund goes down by 33%, then you're stuffed. You know, you're going to have 100% loss. If you have a derivative like a call option, then there's a pretty high probability of 100% loss. In fact, it's 50-50 probably.
This is what I was talking about with making the right investments and sticking to them.
Exactly. So if you go for the lottery tickets, I think that's the problem.
And that is another aspect of prospect theory, is that people overvalue lottery ticket investments. And if you say there's a one in a million chance, people treat it as if it's like a one in a thousand chance or whatever.
Yeah, they overestimate the expected payoff for things like lottery tickets. But it's not just about lottery tickets, of course. Lots of investments are like lottery tickets. Private equity, for example, or perhaps meme stocks or call options. You know, some people see those as a kind of lottery ticket.
I mean, what I took away from prospect theory and this idea of loss aversion is that Kahneman says we hate losses so much that we're willing to make inconsistent gambles in the hope of avoiding them. So, for example, people sell their winning stocks too early because they want to bank some profits. And counter to that, people are so reluctant to sell their losers at a loss because they think, oh, if I hang on, it'll get back into the black and I won't have made a loss.
Yeah, I mean, that explains that kind of behavior.
Which is the wrong kind of behavior. We should be looking at the investments in our portfolio as if we're making a new decision today, right? Do we like them based on what we know today?
Yeah, exactly right. And I think the other kind of thing which comes out of prospect theory is why people buy insurance. The expected payoff for insurance is pretty low, but people hate losses, so they're willing to buy insurance. So, for example, it's a strategy called a protected put, and people are willing to overpay for that protection. Usually it's a drag on returns. Usually you'd be better off without the protective put to cushion you on the downside. So sellers of insurance and derivatives, they benefit from this misjudgment of the probability of a payoff.
Never buy the extended warranty when you're buying a product.
But all of these industries, whether it's lottery tickets or insurance, are really just scratching a cognitive itch. For example, with the lottery tickets, what you actually get, according to Kahneman, is the right to dream pleasantly of winning. That's what they're selling.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Like, you anticipate the lottery draw way more, and then you just chuck your ticket in the bin when it doesn't win.
Exactly.
But you had that week of thinking, I might be a millionaire next week.
And with insurance, you purchase peace of mind. That's really what it's about. So I think for some people, it's worthwhile getting that insurance or the lottery ticket, but just size your bets appropriately. That's probably the best way to approach it.
And prospect theory was one of the things cited in the Nobel Prize that Kahneman won in 2002. So it kind of sounds like common knowledge now almost because we've talked about it so much, but it was revolutionary at the time. This idea that people are not rational economic actors. Before Kahneman's work in the 70s, the standard economic models tended to work on the basis that people made perfectly rational decisions.
Yeah, and the problem really is that our minds aren't geared up for that. We don't have the cognitive capacity to think like a computer. And when it comes to probabilistic thinking, we're just very bad at calculating things. In fact, this weekend, I took one of the standard examples from Kahneman, which is the bat and ball thing. Do you know that one?
No, go on.
So you've got a bat and a ball. In total, they're worth £1 and 10 pence. The bat is worth £1 more than the ball. And most people say that the ball is worth 10 pence. But of course, it's not. It's worth 5 pence.
5 pence, yeah. Basic maths.
But people apply this quick thinking approach, and usually it goes wrong.
And this leads us on to what Kahneman talks about as System 1 and System 2 decision-making. He kind of frames it as there's two ways of making decisions. There's System 1, which is more instinctive, quick. You're not thinking about it. And most of the time it gets it right if we're acting in fields in which we're competent. But sometimes it gets it wildly wrong. In that maths example, you just jump to the wrong conclusion. And then System 2 is more slowed down, considered, but it takes a lot of mental effort, so we can't use it very often.
So if you hear a rustling in the bushes, it could be a saber-toothed tiger. You probably don't want to think too hard about it. You just run.
System 1, yeah. I certainly have a saber-tooth aversion.
But this also led to a branch of biological theory, which is looking at how evolution creates these biases because they help us in survival.
They're there for good reasons. And that's why investing seems so counterintuitive, because you have to fight your biases because it's all about long-term planning and thinking.
Yeah, what worked on the savannah is not going to work in the markets, unfortunately.
And this idea of two decision-making systems is what he really popularized with his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which I imagine many people will have read.
Yes, it's a great book. If you haven't read it, definitely take a look.
And in it, he does describe and go into detail about how these two systems work. And he's clear that these aren't like physiological things in the brain. There's not literally two systems making decisions. It's more of a metaphor for how we think. And he goes on to talk about various different cognitive biases which come out of the way these systems interact with each other. And perhaps the main one is overconfidence bias. When you talk to people about how confident they are in their decisions and their likelihood of being right, people are way, way too confident and overestimate their probability. And the obvious example is that almost everyone thinks they're an above average driver.
And the other time when this becomes a problem for investors is if you've got a view about what's going to happen in the future, you're overconfident and very poor at judging how accurate your forecast is likely to be.
And that's true even for experts as well, supposed experts.
Yeah, and the best decision makers are the ones who not only make good forecasts, but who also know when they should be confident and when they shouldn't.
But they often have a nuance to how they talk, which is not going to play well in the news media. You want someone who comes out and says, this is what's going to happen, panic, or put all your money in.
Yeah, if you have a profit, you don't want a probabilistic profit.
It's interesting that Kahneman sort of delves into it a bit more and talks about the biases that lead to overconfidence. So one is the narrative fallacy, which is that we favour a sort of coherent story and don't think too carefully about it if it seems to make narrative sense. So our emotions kind of lead us astray there. We like a story.
But if you want to see that, just look at the FT or the Wall Street Journal, and you'll see when they talk about one day market moves, they'll say markets moved because of X, Y, and Z. And then the next hour, the market will move the other way. And they'll say markets move because of this. So, you know, I feel really sorry for these people whose job is that they have to describe one day moves, but often it's just random noise.
Yeah, definitely. You'll see like a rate decision from the Fed and they'll keep rates steady and publish some commentary with loads of words. And then the market's up a bit and they write, oh, it's dovish. And then it whipsaws, the market goes down and say, oh, actually, no, the investors have digested it more. Now they see the true hawkishness of Jerome Powell. But yeah, it's noise.
Well, my other favourite is this is already priced into markets. You know, that's a huge catchphrase which covers why markets didn't move the way you think.
And the other interesting bias that plays out with overconfidence is something called hindsight bias, which is that when we look at events that have happened in the past, we forget how uncertain we were before they happened. So we think, oh, that was an inevitability when you look back at market movements. It was always going to be the case that the market crashed in 2007, 2008. I saw that coming. I know the experts didn't. I kind of knew it was coming.
I like the rebranding of it as knew it all along phenomenon.
I think we all feel that though, don't we? The past looks an inevitability.
Yeah, if you see a big market move, you often think, well, I was thinking about buying that before it surged in value, but I'm so upset that I didn't.
And we forget that we think that about hundreds of things all the time.
And that's why it's important to keep a journal, because it helps you remember exactly what your thought process was when you bought something or sold something. And also writing it down really helps rationalize it. And also having a cooling off period and coming back to it and saying, oh, okay, that's what I thought and I think it still applies, or wait, that makes no sense whatsoever. So this is probably one way you could overcome that bias.
Yeah, it's hard to overcome the biases, though, because the research suggests that even when you tell people about all the biases and how they affect your thinking, it's very hard to beat them. Like, knowing about them isn't a good vaccine.
Yeah, these biases exist, but they don't apply to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way around them, typically, is to standardize your decision-making process and go through a checklist and a formula to stop yourself jumping to conclusions and being overconfident and all these things.
So at least if you do have a checklist, you know exactly why you made the decision, what information went into that decision, and if it's wrong later on, you can go back and see if you were just unlucky or the filtering process looked at the wrong information or acted in the wrong way based on that information. So I think it's helpful for documenting things.
And Kahneman in his other book, Noise, refers to this as decision hygiene, which I really like. I think when you're making big investment decisions, you need to have a process which considers all the facts. I mean, I think it's particularly important because the system one they talk about, that more instinctive decision making, is particularly prone to answering the question it wants to answer and thinks it knows the answer to, rather than the actual question at hand. So if you're saying, should I buy Apple stock? that's a tough question to answer, right? There's a million things going into that. Mm-hmm. What your brain jumps to is, do I like the iPhone? Do I like the product? Right? That's what you first think about.
Or all my friends have iPhones. It's that kind of thing.
So you answer the easy question, not the hard question about, oh, let's go through their financial balance sheets and see about their future prospects and their growth. You go to an emotional response first. And good investing is about getting rid of that emotion as much as you can, I think.
And I think expertise also hurts in this case, because I speak to many people who work in IT, or they're doctors, or they're lawyers, and they tend to invest in their own industry because they look at a stock and they think that's a really great company. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good investment, because it could be overpriced or it could be about to issue a profits warning. So really, I think carrying over your professional expertise into investing can also be a problem, partly because it produces this certainty bias. People tend to be overconfident in their decisions because they're good at their job.
Yeah, they're largely separate skill sets, aren't they? You might be a good doctor, but you won't necessarily be good at picking biotech stocks, if anyone is.
Although you might think you are.
You probably will. That's the trouble, isn't it?
Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Are you looking for a new home for your investments? Freetrade has a special offer for you. If you top up or transfer your ISA or SIP with more than £10,000, Freetrade will give you a free share worth between £100 and £2,100. But hurry, this offer ends on 5th of April 2024. Freetrade has taken the stress out of transferring with their purpose-built modern technology. And to keep your mind at ease, customers benefit from FSCS protection. Freetrade won Best Online Trading Platform at the British Bank Awards 5 years in a row. And more than 1.5 million users trust them with their investments. Join today to access over 6,100 US, UK and European stocks, ETFs and investment trusts. So how does the offer work, you may ask? Whether you're an existing customer or looking to transfer your ISA or SIP from a different provider, make sure you open either an ISA or a SIP with an annual standard or plus subscription on or before 5th of April 2024, and keep your account open with a balance above £10,000. You'll be awarded the free share within 90 days. To get started, head over to freetrade.io/transfer or check the link in the episode description below. Capital is at risk. ISA and SIP eligibility, tax rules and terms and conditions apply. Free share value varies depending on the amount topped up or transferred. Annual subscription required.
But there's an even more insidious bias that lurks, even if we go through this formal decision-making process and get to what we think is the right answer, and then we look around at other information that's coming in. We have this bias where we pay attention to the information that confirms our decision. We ignore, to a large degree, the stuff that contradicts what we're thinking.
And perhaps one way to overcome that is to deliberately go to sources of information that contradict what your beliefs are. But it's very difficult to do because it creates a kind of cognitive dissonance. You've got your beliefs, you read the article, and you just think, oh, that can't be right. Whereas you should be thinking, well, maybe that is right and I'm wrong.
Yeah. Or you read the article and you identify one thing in the article, which is definitely wrong. You know that's wrong for a fact. And then you dismiss everything else they've said. Yeah. You're like, well, they've made a mistake. It's wrong. Even though they might have 10 other good points in there. Hopefully no one applies that theory to our podcast. We'd be in big trouble.
Well, let's say you buy a stock and it goes up in value. You never think, oh, I was just lucky. You always think, well, I'm a genius. You know, I could spot that one a mile away.
Yeah, one of the great investing lessons can be summed up in this quote from Kahneman. He says, in a rising market, enough of your bad ideas will pay off so that you'll never learn that you should have fewer ideas.
That's great.
But it does kind of get to the heart of why becoming an expert stock picker, for example, even if it was possible, is so difficult. It's because the market is largely noise and random moves on a short-term basis. And you don't get that immediate feedback that allows you to build up skill. If you're learning to drive a car, you make a mistake, it's pretty obvious straight away. The horns start honking, you smash your bumper, whatever. You don't get that in investing, or at least you don't get it reliably. Like you might buy something and it goes down, but that could just be luck. It often is.
And we're not good at looking over long periods of time. I think that's the other problem. If you're a day trader, then you do get feedback. But what we don't realize is that our minds are really good pattern recognizers. And you often apply a pattern or create a pattern on noise. For example, in a random walk down Wall Street, there's a beautiful example where we have these randomly generated sequences by coin flipping, essentially. And people look at it and they're convinced they can spot a trend, whereas in fact it is completely random.
The system, one way of thinking, is especially seduced by patterns, I think, or apparent patterns. That's how it builds its instinctive knowledge. It says, I've heard a rustle in the bushes before, didn't end well, let's run, right? It just gets that pattern, even though most of the time the rustle is a bird.
But you also see it with other investors. So for example, people look at a well-known active investor and they'll say, look, they were spot on about this particular crisis. So that means they're just brilliant at spotting crises in future. What they don't consider is how many other crises that investor has predicted. And often they overpredict crises or underpredict them. So really, I think you have to be aware that this applies to your investment with active investors as well as it applying to you.
The other thing you see is that when someone gets famous for predicting a market crash, people look to them to predict future market crashes. So if they stop predicting crashes, then no one would pay attention to them.
And it just gets so many clicks. You know, a video about a market crash gets 10 times the number of views about a video that would say, well, everything's actually okay and likely to stay okay.
I mean, it's the loss aversion thing playing out really there, isn't it? That we're panicked about losses, so we pay attention to bad news about crashes. But sometimes the loss aversion phenomenon can be sort of hacked into our favor. So for example, people don't pay enough attention to fees in general, right? And it's hard to get them to care about the difference between a 0.1% fee and a 1% fee, even though over the long term, that makes a huge difference. And if you go on the thing we've mentioned before, the T-Rex calculator, and you see the compounded impact of those higher fees over time, it looks like a loss, right? Because it shows you what you would have had, and now you've got a loss of £300,000 over your investment career. And it taps into that loss aversion, and it makes us care. So you can sort of hack it to help yourself.
Yeah, whenever I'm talking to people about fees, I always use that T-Rex calculator because of the way it reframes losses. And people are shocked, terribly shocked, when they see what's going on.
And you do need to find ways to sort of trick your mind into caring about the right things. Because long-term investing is hard to stay the course. One of the things that Kahneman talks about specifically is not looking at your portfolio too often. So he says, if owning stocks is a long-term project for you, following their changes constantly is a very, very bad idea. It's the worst possible thing you can do because people are so sensitive to short-term losses. If you count your money every day, you'll be miserable.
So for example, if you're a dead investor, you're actually a very good investor because you won't fiddle with a portfolio. And so trust funds, where money's put into a fund and it's not fiddled with, usually performs very well. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that Kahneman wasn't an economist, although he got the Nobel Prize for economics. He was a psychologist. That's how he trained. So his background's actually really interesting.
Yeah, so he was born in 1934. In what is today Tel Aviv, Israel, just on a visit, I think. His mother was visiting. But then he was raised in France and spent most of his childhood hiding from the Nazis in barns and chicken coops, I read, across the French countryside. And there's this story about how there was a curfew and he was a young boy and he was walking home from a friend's house and one of the SS guards actually ran into him, bumped him, and Kahneman, as a kid, was covering up his gold star, which showed that he was Jewish. And the guard picked him up and actually hugged him and like gave him some money and stuff. And then Kahneman ran home to his mother and sort of realized that people are more complicated than you might think at that point.
What an incredible story.
Yeah. I mean, he obviously went to the US in the 50s and did a doctorate in psychology and then spent most of the 60s in Jerusalem before returning to America and working at Princeton University. And in fact, he was the first non-economist to receive the Nobel Prize in economics, because I don't believe there is a Nobel Prize for psychology. So you have to sort of stray into something else. But it's important to know he didn't work alone. And he was quick to say that. It was always a team effort. And he had a long-term research partner, Amos Tversky, who died in the 90s, who contributed a huge amount to his work.
And as with any academic, he built on the shoulders of giants. So for example, a lot of the ideas about heuristics came from Herbert A. Simon in papers he published in the 1950s. But then Tversky and Kahneman built on those ideas and took it to another level. And I didn't realize he was a very big Fortran programmer. So he loved programming in Fortran. There aren't many of those around anymore.
What's that mean for the non-nerds amongst us?
It's just a really old language, a scientific language that was used for calculations, and it's really not used much anymore at all.
I mean, he was a really old guy, right? In 20 years, you'll still be using R and people will be saying that about you. Why does he still use R?
You know what? That's absolutely true. Everyone else is using Python and they think, Romin, I think you should start using Python, but I just carry on using R.
You know how I realized that you'd been super influenced by Kahneman? When I read that him describe the most important question to ask before making a decision is, what is the base rate?
But this is base rate neglect. This is what people often get wrong, which is before you know anything else about a problem, what are the probabilities of a certain thing happening? So for stocks, for example, the most likely thing is that the entire stock market will go up. And that's been a hugely strong pattern over the last 120 years. But people get completely hung up about crashes, which are quite unlikely. And they ignore the base rate, which is a steady upward movement well above the rate of inflation. So that's why I'm always banging on about base rate. I think it's a mistake because nobody knows what on earth base rates are. It's a bit of an odd phrase.
Yeah, it's the kind of standard pattern that you'd assume would happen if you didn't know anything specific about the current situation, right?
Yeah. And decision makers always use base rates, good decision makers. That's their starting point. And then they factor in information about things that they currently know, which might alter those base rates.
It's harder to use the base rate thing when you're looking at individual stocks or new novel investments, right? Like if you were talking about Bitcoin 10 years ago, what is the base rate?
It's very difficult to know. And I think that's a problem. And I think we can't really estimate it for things which haven't been around for long.
I did read that Kahneman said, don't get too hung up on base rates or you'd never get married, right? If you look at the divorce statistics. And I think he proposed to his wife and said, oh my God, like 40% end in divorce or whatever. And she said, Danny, forget about the base rates for now.
But he did have a successful marriage, didn't he?
Oh yeah, they were together like four decades or something. But it's true though, isn't it? Like people would never found businesses or become entrepreneurs if they got too hung up on the fact that most businesses fail in the first 5 years. Sometimes you got to lean into your overconfidence and just go for it.
And again, I think people think, well, I know the base rate is that it's not going to succeed, but it won't apply to me. I'm really good.
But that's good for the economy, right? We need people like that. If everyone abided by base rates, we'd be pretty stuffed.
Yeah, I think a lot of this rationality stuff forgets the fact that noise is actually useful. So, for example, if you do work with neural networks, and this is a nerdy bit for nerds, they get stuck in local minima, where they apply a certain pattern to data, but it's not the optimal pattern, it's not a global optimum. And the only way to break out of that is to apply noise. So there is a kind of optimal amount of noise that you have to add to a system in order to learn effectively, which is quite surprising, but actually a pretty robust result. So I think, you know, avoiding noise altogether, being completely rational, like you say, isn't necessarily a good thing for the economy or for us as investors.
It's interesting about noise. His whole second book is called Noise. And to me, it was even more enlightening, I would say, than the Thinking Fast and Slow book. Because when it comes to decision-making, what I had often thought about is bias, which is where you're consistently skewing your decision in the wrong way, which obviously leads to suboptimal outcomes. But what he's talking about in noise more is that when you're faced with identical decisions, either one person or a group of people making decisions, despite the questions being the same, you will give a range of answers over time. And that's the noise. Like you're not always giving the perfect answer. And in fact, when he looked at the statistics, bad decisions more often come from this noise in the decision-making process rather than inherent bias. And it's insidious because if you think of the example of a group of archers shooting at a target, let's say they all took their shot and they missed the target, but all their arrows landed in exactly the same wrong spot, you'd go, that's bias. And you'd think there's something wrong, right? You'd think they're bows are all slightly skewy or the wind's blowing in a strong way in one direction or whatever. That needs an explanation and you jump to the explanation. Whereas with noise, if they'd all missed the target but scattered around, you just go, oh, maybe they're not very good archers.
Yeah, it's all about the dispersion and the outcomes. That's really important.
But improving the accuracy in that noisy case is just as important as fixing bias. But you don't notice it. Do you know what I mean? You don't notice that it's going wrong so easily as with bias.
Now, if I was going to be cynical, I'd say that he actually got a lot of consulting business off the back of that book. So maybe that was a kind of bias in his case. But it is interesting, the idea.
I know that he worked with insurance companies where he did what's called noise audits, and he would look at their underwriters. Obviously, they're all facing similar decisions about what premium to charge for a particular piece of insurance. And he asked the management, what is the sort of dispersion? Like, what's the difference between two of your underwriters when they're facing the same decision? And the estimate would be around 10%. A lot of people say it's 10%. It would be a reasonable amount they would differ when facing the same problem. But what he actually found was they differ by an average of 50%. The system is way more noisy than people think.
It's funny because when you're a strategist, in fact, what's best is to have a forecast, which is way different to other forecasters, because that gets you on TV. So there is a kind of adverse selection process there. I mean, if you just have a completely consensus view, nobody's going to want to interview you. But if you say that gold's going to $10,000 or that the stock market's going to crash by 50%, everybody's going to want to interview you. And maybe they'll make fun of you, but it'll certainly get you noticed.
Well, that's the problem with incentives, isn't it? There, the incentive is not to make an accurate forecast. It's to get on TV. And the way you get on TV is not by giving accurate forecasts.
But I bet that fund managers don't do this. I bet they don't say, okay, you know, Bob and Mary, you come up with an asset allocation and don't talk to each other, and then we'll compare them and see why they're different and if they're different. And I'm sure they'd come up with very different allocations to randomly selected strategists or fund managers.
Yeah, and it's important that they would make those assessments individually and separately, like you say. Because one point Kahneman makes is that meetings, where you all get around a table and talk about something, are incredibly bad ways of coming to decisions, because the first person to speak has a hugely outsized impact on the opinions of everyone else and what they say.
An anchoring bias. And if it's a boss, it's even stronger because you don't want to upset them.
Yeah, he calls this the ordering effect, that the information you hear first massively outweighs the information you hear later. So if, for example, someone described Romin as intelligent, hardworking, strategic, suspicious, and selfish, you'd think, okay, he's a good guy with a flaw. But if you describe Romin as selfish, suspicious, strategic, hardworking, and intelligent, you'd think, oh, he's a bit of a wrong'un, Romin, even if he's cunning at the same time. The same words, but the order makes a huge difference.
Yeah, let's just hope it's not the latter. I don't think it is.
But the point is that they're the same person, right? And it's this phenomenon of ordering. And if you're making a collective decision, maybe even within your family, like with your partner or parents or whatever it might be, you should have a good, strong think about everything before you present your thoughts to each other.
But this also applies if you're being interviewed for a job, for example. People tend to remember the first candidate and the last candidate. The guys in the middle usually just fall by the wayside.
And if you're in court facing criminal charges, apparently the best time to be sentenced is just after lunch, when the judges have got a nice full belly. And they're more lenient at that time. Apparently the data backs that up.
I remember that.
So much of Kahneman's work focuses on what can go wrong. How we can think we're doing the right thing, but really our minds are tricking us through all these different effects. And so one way he talks about to manage that risk is that when you're making the kinds of investments that are more on the gambling side of the spectrum, limit your risk and constrain the amount of money you're willing to put into them.
Yeah, I think he said it's like going to the casino with only $200. It helps protect you from regret. And this is where the idea of a fund portfolio came from. You know, I thought, well, I want to try stuff out and I want to get some skin in the game and learn stuff. And the best way to do that is to buy things and make losses or potential gains, maybe. And the fund portfolio, if I scale it appropriately, will stop me from destroying my overall wealth, but it'll allow me to scratch that itch to do these kind of lottery ticket investments.
And it's good that you know that you're likely to underperform the market, right? Because a lot of people don't know that. And the professionals have to build their careers pretending, I guess, that they can beat the market, even when all the evidence shows that it's so unlikely.
Yeah, I guess they just ignore that evidence. It was certainly never discussed when I worked in banking that most people underperform, even professional managers.
And just to finish, I read kind of the perfect quote from Kahneman summing up this fact, where he said, "All behavioral economists are against active investing. I might as well say it outright, because we think the market is unpredictable or very, very difficult to predict. And yet we believe people who believe they can predict the market. That illusion is very important."
Now, one way to avoid these kind of biases is to have an accountability group. This is a group of people who you trust, who try and steer you in the right direction. And I think that's one of the reasons why membership in PensionCraft is a particularly useful one. So if you want to learn more about that, just go to our website, pensioncraft.com.
Okay, today's dumb question of the week is, are stock analysts' price targets worth anything? So you'll often see this in the media where some analyst from an investment bank says, "I'm upgrading my price target for Google from $150 to $200. And then inevitably the market has a bit of a bump. People pay attention, supposedly.
Now, I think it's worthwhile listening to these forecasts, if only because it tells you what the consensus is. If people follow that consensus, how will they act? If they think the S&P is going up 10%, 20%, then they'll buy the S&P. And then you can take it to a completely different level, one level higher, and say, how can I beat that behavior if I know that people will be following the consensus? And you can take it to as many levels as you like. And this is one famous example that Keynes came up with when he noticed that he wasn't doing particularly well with his investments. But when he was looking at what people were doing, they did tend to follow some kind of herd behavior. So really what you're doing is not buying what you think will be the best stock. It's what you think other people will think is the best stock. And he called that like a beauty contest, because if you want to predict the winner of a beauty contest, you'll choose the person who other people thinks is most beautiful.
Is it now not the case that you're trying to think what the algorithms will think are the most beautiful stocks, or what the indexes will include?
Yeah, I think that's partly true. And it's certainly true that if you buy a stock which is included in an index that previously wasn't, there's a bit of a bump in the price. So index inclusion is certainly something which is market moving.
But to go back to single stock analysts, did you work with these kind of people? How do they go about their jobs? I'm imagining they took their job seriously and were trying to make accurate price forecasts, or was it the phenomenon they were trying to get on TV? Like, which one was it?
I think it's a bit of both. They didn't try and deliberately get it wrong, but having something which is non-consensus is more likely to get you in front of clients. And that's what it was really all about, because those clients vote for you in the research awards, and then your bonus depends on how many votes you get within those surveys.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You got to win the award?
Yeah. So if you're considered to be the best analyst in telecoms, and that's according to the vote in one of these surveys, and the people who vote for that would be the fund managers themselves, then you get a fat bonus. That's the way it works.
Why isn't it done on who's making the most accurate forecasts?
Maybe they've changed it since I left investment banking, but frankly, I doubt it.
I think the bigger thing at play here is the kind of anchoring bias, where what we're comparing the current stock price to changes based on these analyst forecasts, and therefore it seems more reasonable for it to rally or it to crash. Now, there's no new market moving information in an analyst forecast other than the forecast itself. You know, they don't have inside information, I presume, which says sales are going to be super weak in a year's time. It's just that the market cares about these few opinions because it changes the anchor.
And every year I have a kind of fun little game where I look at the forecast for the S&P 500 for the end of that year, and I look to see how well they've done in the past. And it's very clearly a recency bias forecast. For example, when the COVID thing hit, people were far too pessimistic. But then once things started to improve, they very quickly turned around and said, oh, right, we're going to have very bullish forecasts. But then we got the tech wreck in 2022. So I think the thing to understand is that these analysts are also subject to these cognitive biases like recency bias.
Are analyst forecasts in the aggregate less accurate than just going with the base rate?
Yes, I believe they are. Just look at one of those hairy charts, that's what they call them, and it shows you what the forecasts are at the beginning of the year and how they change over the course of the year as information flows in. And you can see that all they're doing is adjusting what's kind of like a long-term average to what they've observed recently.
I kind of like all the analysts, though, and the game they play. I think it would be a much more boring market without all this commentary going alongside it. It's the game, right? You don't want it to just be algorithms fighting algorithms and no one watching.
Yeah, and it's great fun to make fun of them when they get it wrong.
If a market crashes in the woods and there are no analysts to forecast it, does it make a noise? No, it doesn't. Thank you for joining us for Many Happy Returns. Do send us your questions, no matter how dumb, at the email address mhr@pensioncraft.com.
And do remember to check out pensioncraft.com for all the information about our membership and investment coaching options.
Many Happy Returns is a PensionCraft production, co-hosted and executive produced by Romin Nakiza and Michael Pugh. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes and is not financial advice. We do not provide recommendations or endorse any decision to buy, sell, or hold any security. We cannot be held responsible for any actions listeners may take, and investors are encouraged to seek independent financial advice.